could be a political opportunity for India's ruling party, the BJP, and others. The BBC's Yogita Limai reports now from Prayagraj, formerly known as Allahabad.
One by one, holy men who've come from all over India jump into the water. Some are entirely naked, ash smeared on their bodies, with long hair and flowing beards. Chanting the name of a Hindu god, they splash around in waters considered most sacred in the religion. It's where the rivers Yamuna and Ganges meet. This bathing marks the beginning of the Kumbh, the world's largest festival. It takes place in Allahabad once every 6 or 12 years. After the religious men come the ordinary people, a sea of them. Many have traveled more than 1,000 miles to the festival. I'm by the banks of the river, and in front of me, literally hundreds of people who have come here to take the dip. Men, women, children, elderly people, families that have come here together. Some walk in very confidently, offer prayers, looking towards the sky, and then immerse themselves in the water. Others tread in more gingerly and take a few minutes before they can muster up the courage to take the dip. And that's because, I'm just putting my hand in the water now. It's icy cold. There's also wind blowing, so it must be freezing inside there. But it is faith that drives these people here.
We feel very good. We believe that Mother Ganges blesses us and fulfills all our wishes. My daughter got a job because of her.
I have come here several times. I get a lot of peace.
I have come because I have heard that all our sins can be washed off by bathing here.
This year the festival comes just a few months before a national election. And so it has more political colour than usual. Posters of government ministers from the ruling BJP party dot the area. On the path leading up to the river are larger-than-life cutouts of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And he's expected to take a dip here later this week. For his Hindu nationalist party, such a large gathering of people from the religion presents a political opportunity.
This is a very opportune moment. Can't get so much people in any political rally. If you organize 100 rallies, then you can find out like this.
Badri Narayan Tiwari, a social historian and anthropologist from Allahabad, says that although there's no overt campaigning at the Kumbh, the government's message is clear.
Earlier, the government were organizing, but they were not in forefront. So they are saying clearly, we are the people who are good to manage this kind of Hindu festivals, and we give importance to Hindu festivals.
From the top, the festival zone looks like a tented town. The money spent on the arrangements has more than doubled since the last Kumbh held 6 years ago. And the land allocated for it has increased by more than a third. That's roughly half the size of the island of Manhattan. The host city's Muslim name of Allahabad has been changed to one from ancient Hindu texts. It will now be called Prayagraj. But BJP leader Praveen Kumar Singh denies there's a political agenda behind it all.
It's just a coincidence that this has come close to the election. Our leaders made the festival a priority because of people's faith in it. Of course, when they experience the good facilities we provided, people will want the same government back.
At the banks, people offer prayers after taking a dip. Oil lamps are lit and little bells are rung as Hindu verses are chanted. Over the next few weeks, more than 100 million people are expected to attend the Kumbh festival, the largest gathering of humanity in the world, just a fraction of India.
Yogita LeMay reporting from Kumbh.
You're listening to News 8 from the BBC with Lawrence and Carney. The main headlines this half hour: Zimbabwe's government has defended its security forces after the country's Human Rights Commission accused them of using systematic torture against protesters. And Britain's most senior counter-terrorism officer has warned that right-wing extremists could exploit the feverish environment in the country as it prepares to leave the European Union. Let's get the sports news now with Matthew.
And we're going to hear a bit more from Serena Williams, stymied once again from challenging for that record-equalling 24th Grand Slam title, this time after exiting the Australian Open in the quarterfinals at the hand of a brilliant comeback from Karolina Pliskova. Williams was 5-1 up and had four match points in the deciding third set before Pliskova went on a six-game winning run to take the set and the victory. And the great Williams, even 23 Grand Slam successes in, is still taking lessons.
I just need to make sure I play lights out when I have match points. And it's little things like that that I used to do and that I always do that I need to, like, I need matches to know that, okay, this is when you go psycho when you're up, when you have match points. So it's a good learning experience to know the next time that I have match point, like, okay, just, like, go bananas on it.
You suspect the next time someone comes up against Serena with match points to her name, they may not stage a comeback. Pliskova will play Naomi Osaka in the semis. And the other line from Australia, Frenchman Luca Puy is into his first Grand Slam semi after a four-sets win over Milos Raonic. He'll play either Novak Djokovic or Kei Nishikori. All the latest sport today, 19:30 GMT.
Matthew, thank you. Now, high fashion in the business news and results from Burberry out this morning. Will Bain is back in his Burberry suit.
I wish, Connie. I think that's more Lawrence Pollard's salary that gets him Burberry goodies. Us mere mortals like me and Matthew Kenyon, we stick to more high street brands, I think. Results that I think might come as a sigh of relief, actually, for the high-end luxury British brand and favourite of our presenter, Lawrence Pollard, with sales up just over 1% for the 13 weeks, including Christmas, which was a smidge under predictions. Maria Malone is principal fashion business lecturer at Manchester Metropolitan University. And I say a sigh of relief, Maria, because the global political winds were kind of against Burberry here, particularly with what's been happening in the Chinese economy.
Yeah, absolutely. They predicted a little bit of a downturn, really, but actually they're holding firm, and it's quite good to see.
And it's all to do with this push that the new chief executive, Marco Gobetti, has had to make it more high-end, so more exclusive, more difficult for us normal people to buy.
Yeah, but also tailoring it more to the younger market, the young rich of China, if you like. And it's a much more, comfort collection, more sporty, more sports look. So it's going in the right direction for their needs.
And what type of Chinese people are buying these things? Is it younger people? Is it older business people?
No, I'd say it's the younger markets. I was in Shanghai recently, and Burberry is definitely being worn by the young rich of Shanghai, definitely.
And it's written out some gaffes, particularly in China. I was sharing this round. Guys, I don't know if people have seen the email that I shared round of this picture of Burberry's advert campaign for Chinese New Year. Maria, I don't know if you can describe it better than me, but I would describe it as almost looking like the Adams family dressed in Burberry gear.
Yeah, everyone looks so miserable. And do you know what? The Chinese people are not miserable. I mean, this could have really been avoided. There's nobody on their main board that understands the Chinese culture clearly. They only had to consult my boss, who's lived and worked in China in the fashion industry for years and understands everything about this. But a phone call or a consultant could have come in and advised them as to how to attract people at this very celebratory time. We don't all go around in Britain with a miserable face at Christmas, do we?
No, exactly. And yet still, despite the kind of gaffe, still desired, as you say. I mean, I guess the key for these luxury things around the world with anything, luxury watches, luxury cars, luxury clothes, is it still something that people really want? In a sort of sentence or two, do you think, is Burberry a brand that people still want, that they aspire to own?
It is. I mean, in China, 40% of their revenue comes from China. And as a British heritage brand, it's still riding strong. And, of course, the collaboration with Vivienne Westwood recently, that is really kind of a force to be reckoned with. Two great British brands in one.
Yeah, so there we go, Lawrence. I know what's on your Christmas list again next year. Yet another Burberry coat for your collection. That's
also
Maria Malone.
Honestly, looking miserable, and Burberry is definitely not Lawrence Pollard.
No.
I should say that the point of this irony is that there is no one worse dressed in the office than me. That is the point. The picture, by the way, that you sent round is an absolute treasure.
If anybody wants to Google, just put through Burberry Chinese Lunar New Year advert into anything your search engines and have a good laugh.
It's a bit dark, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Will Bain, many thanks. Now, let's talk about France and Italy. Relations between the two incredibly close neighbours in every sense seem to be going from bad to worse quite spectacularly today. Now, both of Italy's leaders have taken direct hits at Emmanuel Macron. First, one of the deputy prime ministers, Luigi Di Maio, accused French neo-colonial policies of fueling migration from Africa. And today, on the newswires, we see that the other deputy prime minister, Matteo Salvini, has said he hopes the French don't vote for Macron in the next elections, which, in terms of diplomacy, is about as blunt and naughty as you can get. I suppose the argument was maybe kicked off by Italy feeling abandoned to deal on its own with the migrant flow from Africa, a gravely serious issue, but it's then been fueled by arguments over Libya, oil, budget constraints, charges of hypocrisy. We need two views, one from France and one from Italy. Jacopo Iacobini is an Italian journalist with La Stampa, who's written a book, actually, about the five-star populist movement now in coalition. And Eric Joseph as well, correspondent for the French daily Libération, interestingly, in Italy as well. Jacopo, if I could begin with you, an Italian perspective, did this begin, do you think, with Italy feeling abandoned over migration? Where's it come from, this falling out?
Well, I think it's a very long story because I think it doesn't start quite with the feeling of abandonment over migrations. I think that it's a story which in Italy starts 10, 15 years ago when there started a huge disappointment of the people against the elite, the establishment, the traditional parties, both on the right and the left.
So their own elites, in a sense. That's interesting. So how does this get diverted into despite for France?
Yes, yes. I think that there is a huge feeling of revolt against the elite. And now what we see is the last result of that. And I think that there are three main issues in that. First one is the feeling against the elite. Second one is a very fierce stance over migration from both the League, far-rightist party, and the Five Star, yeah, which share at all this fierce stance. They share at all that stance. And third one, I think that there is a sort of very, very, very strong conflict against Europe and EU.
Which I suppose Macron represents along with Angela Merkel. Eric Joseph, French in Italy for La Libération. These comments particularly about French neo-colonialism that were made by the Italian government. I mean, Macron himself has been critical of French colonialism. He made it part of his election. So what do the French feel when they hear Italians saying you're a bunch of colonialists and you're getting us into trouble?
Oh, I mean, it's a kind of an old rivalry between Italy and France, and so now it's a little bit weird to hear about colonialism, even if there are still a kind of relationship between France and Africa, which are that France and Africa didn't cut completely the whole link. So in part there's a part which is true that there are strong relations, but to hear about post-colonialism or new colonialism, it's a little bit weird.
Particularly when Italy has such close relations with Libya, its former colony.
Yeah, or Libya, or also Eritrea. You know, also because the new Italian government attacked France because of the immigrants which would come from French colonies. But in fact, most of the people they come from non-ex-French colonies, and also they come from Italian colonies like Eritrea. So which is a little bit weird.
Yeah, that's a good point. And how much do you think this is about Emmanuel Macron? Because there's this idea of the sort of the central axis of Europe, the liberal axis of Merkel and Macron. The Italian government at the moment feels they don't want to be part of that. They look maybe to Hungary or maybe to Poland. Do you think that the split is that deep between France and Italy?
Oh, I think that there's a lot of propaganda, electoral propaganda, also before the European elections. But but it's true that there is also a strategic division, and it's pushed also by some interest, like the Russian interest, and maybe the Bannon, Steve Bannon ones. And so it's sure that it's first of all it's for electoral public opinion toward the European elections.
That's interesting. Jacopo, do you agree with that? Do you think that this is political froth, that underneath the surface, actually, economic, cultural, financial links are as close as ever between Italy and France?
Yes, there are very strong economic relationship between Italy and France right now, because if you just think at our commercial flows, I think there are 80 billions euro between France and Italy. Wow. So I think that there are a lot of great businesses at risk, for example, in Alitalia, or the shipyards, the chantiers Atlantique and Fincantieri.
They're at risk from this political argument, you think?
Yes, I think that this is very risky, because when you look at the claims of the Italian Vice Prime Minister Luigi Di Maio last Sunday, when he told out of the blue, immediately, totally out of the blue, that France was robbing in Africa, and last Thursday almost the same words were repeated from the other Vice Prime Minister Matteo Salvini, who is also Interior Minister. So you have the strong feeling that there is kind of coordination between those two forces,
and they are being terribly rude as well, so urging the French people not to vote for Macron. How will that go down in France, briefly and finally, do you think, Eric?
Sorry, I didn't hear.
No, I just wonder, how is that going to go down, the fact that Italian leaders are now saying to French, don't vote for Macron?
Oh, I mean that the French government tried not to answer directly. First, Macron wanted to push a kind of division. I mean...
Dignified French response would seem to be the result. Eric Joseph, in Italy, correspondent for Libération, and also Italian journalist Jacopo Iacobini, on the spat or no spat between France and Italy.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the US is made possible by American